Well, hello there. Welcome to the Green Divas Radio Show. I'm your host, Green Diva Meg. I'm sorry I missed you last week. If you have been listening every week, it was post-Earth Day rest time for Green Divas. Anyway, so I'm here with you now, and I'm thrilled that you've tuned in. You know, before we get too far into what's coming up for this awesome show, I wanted to share a poem with you that I was inspired. One of the segments today you'll hear is A Green Diva's Heart Wildlife with John Platt, who has been writing a series for Scientific America called Extinction Countdown. And today we talked about tigers. And while there was some interesting news about them, perhaps not being as endangered, he tells us why that may not be so and actually tells us a lot of really, like, awful things that, you know, we need to know and understand and help stop. I kind of went and found a poem that I thought was kind of cool. It's called Sumatran Tiger. Here we go. Through the forests of Sumatra, through the dark and sweaty jungle, proud and fearless pads the tiger. Pads through bamboo, palm, liana, powerfully swims across the water, webbed feet pounding against the current, unaware of near extinction. Forest dwindling, disappearing, shrinking by illegal logging, teak for tables, chairs, and profit. Will our tiger last the decade? To our children, ancient history? Ancient history, myth, and mystery, with the sun bear and the hornbill? Spring into action like the tiger, planting trees and education. Guardians of unique creatures, we can save the Sumatran tiger. That's a poem by Mike Jones. Anyway, now you know about one of the segments coming up. But before we get into any more of that, I want to tell you what's on thegreendivas.com, because you're going to want to go check it out. A really nice article by Dave Room, who is also known as Malia's Papa and one of the co-creators of Pacha's Pajamas. He did an article, Beyond the Hero's Journey and How Awakening Stories Can Create Change. It's a very thoughtful piece, goes along with the podcast. Check it out. I have a new 1 GD minute video tutorial on making non-toxic bug spray. It's super easy, super effective. Check that out. So today we feature Alicia Graves from Oasis Initiative, all about population and the climate change connection. Green sex for climate's sake. Ha ha ha. Anyway, it's an important issue, and I'm hoping you'll stay tuned for that. We're doing a replay of Green Dude segment with Van Jones. It was really good segment. He's so cool. And we have a Green Divas Health and Beauty segment with Brigitte Mars, all about memory and how we can support our memory with herbs and nutrition. Green Divas Green Thumb, a 2-minute gardening segment all about growing herbs. And Green Divas Heart Wildlife, like I mentioned, with John Platt, about tigers. In the meantime, I'm really enjoying interacting with all of you out there in social media land. At Green Diva Meg for me on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram, at Green Diva Meg. And, of course, at The Green Divas on Instagram and Twitter, and The Green Divas Radio Show on Facebook. But I'm also going to ask you to please subscribe to our YouTube channel, because I've got all these new videos. I think I did 2 videos last week. They're short, they're sweet, hopefully informative and fun at the same time and entertaining. Really appreciate the support. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the rest of the show. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Pam Narney may be witnessing the effects of global warming right in her own backyard. Each year, ospreys nest on her property near the Potomac River in rural Virginia. She loves watching the birds in action.
Most of the time, they fly along the surface of the water and stick their talons down and grab the fish. But when they go straight down, it's just your heart stops.
Narni's not a scientist, but she records data on the osprey's behavior, including when they return each year.
They usually return somewhere between March 4th and March 18th.
But in the last few years, the birds have been returning several weeks early.
This year was the earliest ever, which was February 25th.
Narni's observations are consistent with a recent report by the Audubon Society, which says the osprey's winter range will expand north as climates warm. But that does not mean this magnificent bird will benefit from climate change. The same report estimates that up to 80% of the osprey's summer range will be lost within 65 years. So while Narni enjoys watching the osprey for a bit longer each year, she realizes this change could be an ominous sign of global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Every Green Diva needs a sidekick. At the Green Divas radio show, they're called Green Dudes. Time now for a deeper shade of green from a guy's perspective.
Well, this is really a big honor for me. I've been personally following this guy for many years, and if you haven't heard from him, crawl out from under your rock and check him out. He's really an advocate for so many things, and he's tying the need for environmental awareness with social justice and human rights in so many ways. Van Jones, who is an activist, he's an author. One of the books is The Green Collar Economy, which is specific to what we talk about here. He's the founder of Green for All, among many other organizations that are doing wonderful work for social justice and social economy, social environmentalism. He's also worked for President Obama. So let's just launch in. Hi, Van. How are you?
Oh, I'm really glad to be on the phone with you, that's for sure.
Well, I'm like stumbling. I'm like a little fangirl, you know. You're a hero to many of us who
very kind
believe in the work that you're doing and the importance of it. So one of the things that we thought we'd talk about today was what's going on with Obama's clean power plan.
Well, I think it's probably the biggest climate victory that you never heard of.
Right.
Basically, over the course of the summer, the president revealed through the EPA, new rules that all the big, dirty power plants are going to have to comply with to basically clean up their act. Now, people remember when he first came into office, he said he was going to take on climate, and he wanted to do it with the cap and trade bill,
right,
which is, you know, very pro-business, pro-market, very similar to stuff that Mitt Romney and others had endorsed, John McCain and others had endorsed.
Yeah.
But you know, once he decided he was going to be for it, and suddenly the Republicans said it was socialism, they couldn't touch it. We're like, isn't this your idea?
This is such an oppositional environment, isn't it?
Yeah, very dysfunctional, very tribal.
Yeah.
Very tribal environment.
It's weird, yeah.
So what happened is that because he could not get it done through the legislature, he noticed that the Supreme Court had given George W. Bush the authority and the power under the Clean Air Act to directly regulate carbon. He goes, well, hold on a second. I don't have to go crawling through this crazy minefield of Congress. I can just take the EPA, which Richard Nixon created,
yeah,
and the Clean Air Act, which Richard Nixon created, and the conservative Robert Supreme Court, and use that authority to tell the polluters to pollute less. And he did that. And what that means is that in all 50 states, there will be tables and debates and discussions set up to figure out how to implement those rules.
Yeah.
Now, you can implement those rules in a way where you can create an awful lot of jobs in solar and weatherization and wind energy, and I think Americans should be waking up to the possibility,
yeah,
to create a bunch of jobs here.
I mean, think about like what Roosevelt did with the New Deal and all of the WPA and all the stuff that got done and some wonderful work that got done during that time to help lift everybody out of that depression. And, of course, we're coming out of our economic difficulties, and what a great way to do it, to create this new infrastructure, right?
Well, absolutely, and the good thing about it is that in this case, it's just about you don't have to change the public expenditures, you just change the public rules. You know, these polluters have been, subsidized to the hilt mainly by being able to pollute for free. You know, you and I can't pollute for free. If you walk out your front door and throw a can on the ground, you're going to get a fine.
But these
big mega polluters can dump out megatons of carbon, you know, year after year and never pay one single penny. If you got a $25 fine for littering, you just paid $25 more than any big polluter in the United States has ever had to pay at the federal level for dumping out megatons of carbon. So the great thing about changing the rules the way the president has done is that without changing your tax payment, guess what? All these polluters have to say, well, crap, we're going to have to net reduce pollution, but we aren't going to reduce our energy production. What does that mean? You're going to have to be more efficient, and you're going to have more clean energy. That means solar jobs, solar contracts, energy efficiency jobs, weatherization jobs, contracts for that. So this is a huge opportunity. The thing that people don't talk about enough is that the green economy is the best pathway to more work, more wealth, and better health.
Yeah.
You want to start taking the asthma inhalers out of people's pockets. You want to start giving people contracts and jobs and putting people to work again. Just move in a clean energy direction, because that is going to be where so much of the job growth is coming. We're in the middle of a solar energy boom right now because the cost of solar has really just fallen through the floor. And so that's bad for the solar manufacturers because a lot of them got put out of business. But the solar distributors, the solar installers, it is a great opportunity for them. And any consumer right now, if you have a house that has a roof, which I think is most houses, you should be looking at putting up solar panels right now. The cost is just unbelievably low.
Yeah, if not solar panels, at least a green roof.
Sure, something.
I saw your video of with the green roofs. That was a very, very cute and informative. I also was watching your video, your TED Talk on economic injustice of plastic, and it was a brilliant message about the people that are most affected by pollution, whether it's plastic or the carbon going into our atmosphere and causing more asthma.
People often see folks fussing at people around having the plastic water bottles, and you know, we all use them occasionally. I've been chastised or sometimes using them on a stage. You know, you're up there, you're dying, somebody hands you a plastic water bottle. I'm not going to throw it, hit somebody in the head with it. They've already handed it to me. It's open. But you know, it does create problems, because literally at the point of the production, you go down to Cancer Alley down there in Louisiana, where a lot of this plastic is manufactured. A lot of sick kids, a lot of cancer. And then where it's disposed of, you say, I'm recycling. I'm great, I'm recycling. Well, you should recycle. It's better than just throwing it on the ground or putting it in a landfill. But some of these recyclers are not that ethical, and sometimes they just ship them over to China, and you got kids just burning the plastic and melting it down, and they're getting sick. So it basically, we all use plastic. We live in a plastic society, but you should try to use less of it. And I'm not going to be one of these guys. If you use one plastic water bottle, you're responsible for the destruction of the planet.
Oh, it's impossible.
I use them too if they hand them to me, but honestly, it's a bigger problem than most people know.
You know, I did this Rodale's. They had this challenge. They had a bunch of media people try not to use any new plastic for an entire month. It was plastic-free February. I was like, oh, I'm in. Yeah, I hate plastic. I'm good. I got my glass jars, blah, blah, blah. I just became so painfully aware how difficult it is. I mean, I know that there are certain things. I mean, there's medical devices that require plastic, and plastic can save lives. But I think it's almost like it's another resource, and we have to really be mindful about how we use it.
I think that's true. You know, one thing I'm so proud of, you know, being one of the founders of Green for All, not Green for Some. But we're Green for All, and, you know, greenforall.org is a resource center for people who are really interested in this stuff. Often people associate the environmental cause with very elite, very privileged, very wealthy constituency. And I think that the media really tries to push that image because it limits how many people identify with the cause. But the reality is that, you know, African-Americans, Latinos, when you poll our communities, actually poll off the charts and poll better than the average white voter on environmental issues. In part because, frankly, we don't spend a lot of time watching Fox News and on some of these other outlets that confuse a big part of the white population.
Yeah.
We're looking very, honestly at the facts and the idea that, hey, listen, we want to live in cleaner neighborhoods. We want to have cleaner air. We want to have cleaner water. And there's not a big constituency inside of our community saying, well, all that stuff is socialism and it's going to, destroy, freedom. And so, therefore, our communities actually tend to be much more supportive politically and also are much more open to solutions, even if you say that it may cost more to have clean air and clean water. African Americans and Latinos say that's fine. They understand the public health implications. So, really, the actual environmental movement is much broader than most people think. It's much more diverse than most people know.
Yeah.
It's much more hopeful and optimistic than most people understand. Because people are looking for, nobody thinks if you're a Latino kid growing up someplace in Texas that you're going to get a great job in a coal mine.
Yeah.
There's no African Americans in Ohio thinking they're going to get great jobs on oil rigs.
Right.
But all of those young people can imagine having a solar future, having a future where energy efficiency with computers is a big part. And we got to lift those voices up a lot better than we do. And Green for All is focused on that.
Yeah, it's really an important piece that we've been trying to focus on more and more. And so I appreciate what Green for All is doing. And we've got as Green Divas and with our platform, really are committed to trying to be more focused on that because it is for all. So I'm watching videos kind of preparing for this, and I see that you get a shout-out from President Obama. I mean, how many people get a shout-out from President Obama?
Well, he's a pretty generous guy, so I'm sure quite a few, but we sure were happy when he gave me one.
That was cool. Yeah. That was about your work with criminal justice reform.
Sure. To me, it's all one struggle. It's all one fight. It's all one cause. We don't have any throwaway resources. We don't have any throwaway species. We also don't have any throwaway neighborhoods or nations or children either.
Yeah.
It's all precious. It's all sacred. When you have mass extinction of our sister and brother species and mass incarceration of our sisters and brothers, there's something wrong with our civilization. Something has gotten way off track. The United States alone is kind of still the center of the world economy, challenged somewhat by China, but still we're the dominant dominant force. As consumers, if not as producers, we are still producing 25% of the world's greenhouse gases and 25% of the world's prisoners, even though we only have 5% of the world's population.
Yeah.
Now, when you only have 5% of the world's population and one out of every four carbon molecules cooking the planet is coming from you, and you only have 5% of the world's population and one out of four people locked up anywhere in the world are locked up by you, and you're the land of the free, and you say you believe in America the beautiful. Well, wait, hold on a second.
Yeah, what's
How
up
much
with...
beauty are we defending and supporting when we're messing up the whole climate? And how much freedom can you have when you have such a massive prison industry?
Well,
and so we fight the polluters and the prisons.
Yeah, I'm so with you on that. It's very upsetting, and we could probably talk about that for another 20 minutes. But again, thank you for that. So what's the next big thing? What's your next big exciting project that we want to know about?
Well, I just want people to know that they can support Green for All, greenforall.org, in our effort to make sure that the Clean Power Plan, Obama's new climate rules, get rolled out in a way that really includes everybody, uplifts everybody. You can cut carbon a lot of ways, but I think when you cut carbon, you should cut poverty too. When you cut carbon, you should cut poverty too. When you cut carbon, you should cut hopelessness too by creating more jobs in solar, more jobs in weatherization, more jobs in energy efficiency, more jobs in wind technology. And greenforall.org is a real clearinghouse for these efforts. And I'm so proud that Vien Trung, who is going to be just a massive global ecological heroine, young attorney who just joined our team, and she's now running Green for All. And
good. Well, we'll have to talk to her too.
Yeah, she's amazing. So we're off to the races with Green for All.
All right. Well, that's really exciting, and we will definitely be in touch as that progresses and hopefully speak with her. In the meantime, thank you again for all that you're doing, and hope you have some wonderful holidays.
Well, you too, and thanks to you for your great work and lifting up the voice and giving people like me an opportunity to be heard.
Want more information on this Green Dude segment and other ideas for low-stress green living? Go to thegreendivas.com. That's greendivas.com.
Vibrant health and beauty radiates from the inside out. Get your glow on with Green Diva's health and beauty tips, from natural skincare to creating healthier habits that make us sparkle.
Back again with one of our favorite Green Diva herbalists, our go-to herbalist, Brigitte Mars, who is the author of many books, the most recent being Home Reference Guide to Holistic Health and Healing. She's an herbalist, and just we love Brigitte. So, hi, Brigitte.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I was exhibiting exactly why we're doing this particular segment. I had a little brain freeze.
Ah, yes. Well, we're going to talk about memory today. That happens to everybody.
I know. It happens to me, you know. It feels like more than not, but that's okay. So I know that there are all kinds of things you may recommend to help us have a little better brain function.
So according to the principles of Asian medicine, when we think about brain health, we should also be thinking about the health of our kidneys. And so The kidneys really like it when we get lots of minerals. So eating foods that are black in color, like black chia seeds, black rice or wild rice,
All right.
You know, black olives, black sesame seeds. Those
Interesting.
Are just a few examples. So,
okay.
And foods that look a little like the brain, according to ancient folklore, which often proves to be quite true, are to eat foods that look a little like the brain, cauliflower and walnuts and coconut.
Okay.
But also for memory, we need to be present. So we have to admit, it's hard to always be present when we're taking in new information and there's music playing, there's other people talking, there's traffic, there's, you know, just 100 things going on.
Smartphones.
Yes. And so, you know, of course, you're not going to remember things as well as if you're doodling or texting during something where you're trying to take in information. So, you know, really be fully present. I have long been a believer in, like, using a yellow highlighter, and people that are color therapists, I consider myself one, have found that, you know, the color yellow is the color of cerebral stimulus. So if you're reading a book, you know, take a yellow highlighter, providing it's your book and not a library book, and then, you know, highlight that. And then when you're done with the book, go over what you've highlighted in yellow as a way of imprinting it again into your consciousness.
Oh, is that? I never really knew that. I do. Sometimes I use the color pink or green, but now I understand why yellow might be a little bit more important.
You know, yellow is very visible. It's very bright.
Yeah.
And it's a color associated with the nervous system as well as the digestive system. So you might try that. I have even, on days when I needed to be really on, worn yellow, which
yes.
is not really a flattering color on me, but it's said to be really helpful. And, you know, I've talked about some of the foods that are good, but I do think a lot of people have brain fog because they're eating foods that are causing inflammation in the brain.
Oh.
Maybe too much gluten or too much dairy and, you know, things that are, you know, high fat, full of free radicals, fried foods, chips, things like that. So if we want sharper, clearer focus, we want to eat colorful, fresh fruits and vegetables. I think that's really important. And another trick I learned, I think I've known this for like 40 years, is if you're wanting to learn something, smell rosemary essential oil while you're taking in that information. So, for example, if I'm reading notes for a workshop I'm going to teach, I might smell essential oil of rosemary. You know, Shakespeare actually said, there's rosemary for remembrance.
Huh.
Pray thee, love, remember.
Okay.
And then when I go to, like, give the presentation or take the test or whatever it is, or one of my daughters is learning her lines for a play, or a grandchild is studying for a spelling test, when you go back to perform, smell that smell again. And even though you might not be able to bring a bottle of essential oil with you into a test, you could put some on your hairbrush that day so that your hair is surrounding you with a cloud of rosemary, and you might, you could put some on your sleeve or your wrist. So that's another little trick I like to use.
Interesting. I love that idea.
Yeah, and it's so simple, and I think, you know, kids can learn to do this. And we also know that turmeric is a great herb for memory. Turmeric is being found to be so helpful at prevention of, you know, yeast overgrowth, anti-cancer, anti-depression, anti-Alzheimer's. So use turmeric widely. It's often in our chili powder or
curry
powder, yes.
Now, tell me, what's your preference in how to use? I mean, I don't always find the little tubers of fresh turmeric root, but, you know, is the powder okay?
Yeah, you can use the powder, and of course there's a plethora of capsules out there. Many of them contain a little bit of bioperine, which is from black pepper, which is said to enhance the assimilation of turmeric. But there's so many herbs from memory, and I wanted to mention ginkgo biloba.
Yeah.
And ginkgo biloba has long been used as a kidney tonic primarily, but it's also great for memory. And it's been very widely studied. There have been hundreds of studies done in Europe and found that the more someone needs it, the more useful it is. So we know that ginkgo improves circulation to the brain, helps the brain better utilize oxygen and glucose. It improves nerve signal transmission.
Wow. So I better get on that ginkgo thing.
Yeah, go to cola, which is said to be the favorite food of wild elephants, and we all know what they say about wild elephants, that they never forget. So it contains an amino acid called L-glutamine, and also has a history of being used to treat amnesia, dementia, senility. It's said to be revitalizing on the brain cells and the nerves, and in some parts of the world, it's believed that eating a few go-to cola leaves a day will help to keep you young longer. So that can't hurt.
Well, I have a quick question. This is a little bit divergent here, but I have a dear friend who had a terrible accident, had traumatic brain injury and a stroke, and she's really in intense, you know, rehab therapy, rebuilding neuro pathways. Would any of this be appropriate and helpful to her in this process of, you know, relearning and remembering and sharpening her brain back?
I certainly think so. I do. I think that using the herbs, the food, and then, you know, even doing things with our hands, I think would help keep our brains more alert. So even maybe relearning if your friend needs to, you know, how to embroider or knit or crochet. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's a great loss that in our culture, you know, young people are not as often as they were maybe 100 years ago learning to knit, sew, crochet, work with wood,
right.
Play an instrument. And I think that's really important in preventing our mental deterioration. Of course, brain injury happens. Yes, and sometimes we have to relearn, but using our hands is really helpful. Even working with clay could be a helpful technique.
All right. Wow. And I'm sure there's much more, but I know that you will provide us with a wonderful post for thegreendivas.com.
thegreendivas.com. I shall indeed.
But in the meantime, I'm going to ask people to check out your website because there's so much more on a variety of topics in terms of, you know, health and healing and the books you've written and tips and recipes and remedies. BrigitteMars.com, Brigitte, B-R-I-G-I-T-T-E, Mars like the planet.com. And Brigitte, thank you again.
Thanks and gratitude to you and your listeners. Many blessings.
Are you sparkling yet? Well, you will be. For information on this segment and lots of other healthy, green living information, visit thegreendivas.com. That's T-H-E, greendivas.com. Wishing you had a green thumb? or want to learn more about sustainable gardening outdoors and in? Expert Green Divas and Dude Gardeners share tips for everything from composting to growing herbs in your kitchen. Listen to the Green Divas Green Thumb for low-stress gardening tips.
This is Gardening in 2 Minutes. One item that many people may neglect or forget about growing in their garden containers or raised beds is herbs.
Herbs are really easy to grow. Even if you don't have a huge garden, you can grow them in containers. You can grow them in containers year-round. We grow them in containers year-round ourselves in our kitchen. Some do better than others outdoors. But we have a basil plant. We have some sorrel. We've had rosemary. So there's a number of things you can grow.
And what you get at the grocery store and what you pay at the grocery store is crazy, and the varieties are very, very limited. For example, basil, you can get in the traditional basil that we're all familiar with. You can also get basil in cinnamon, lime, lemon, as well as licorice. So it actually tastes like the name it is. So there's a variety of different herbs out there. For example, there's chocolate mint. So there's a number of different herbs that are not necessarily available at the store, but you can certainly grow at your place, in your garden, inside, that pays for itself over and over again throughout the years.
Now, keep in mind, some of these herbs could possibly be invasive, so you might want to do a little bit of research. Mint, I know at times, can be invasive. So do a little bit of research before you plant them in the ground in case you don't want them taking over too much. Or if you want to start a little herb garden, at least you kind of know what to expect.
These herbs can be grown in partial shade. You don't need full sun. And there are some techniques on how to get them to grow longer. Some herbs are perennials, which means they will come back year after year based on how cold your winters are. For more information on growing basil, our weekly video productions, as well as our free downloadable digital quarterly magazine, you can find all that information at
thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.
For the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. For Gardening in 2 Minutes, I'm Joy Baird.
And I'm Holly Baird.
Inspired to grow more organic stuff? We are. To learn more about this Green Divas Green Thumb episode and all kinds of other great green information, visit thegreendivas.com. That's T-H-E, greendivas.com.
I'm Ed Begley, and you're listening to the Green Divas Radio Show, the entertaining source for low-stress ways to live a deeper shade of green and take action for the earth.
Green Divas Heart Wildlife. Who can resist all those videos and images of adorable baby animals? But sometimes these adorable creatures really need our help. Let's celebrate wild animals, learn about them, and do what we can to help them.
All right, well, it's been a while since I had a chance to speak to this awesome green dude, John Platt, who is a journalist, an environmental journalist, you know, and he's been reporting on, among other things, endangered species, and he's been doing a series for Scientific American called Extinction Countdown. And, you know, there's just a lot to be concerned about, but it's probably not a horrible news. I mean, there are – please, John, tell me that there are some victories maybe.
Oh, no, there's not a single victory out there. No, that's not true at all. There are actually a lot of wildlife victories and a lot of endangered species victories, and that's the interesting thing about this beat. You know, I'll write about a species going extinct, but you've got people out there that are doing fantastic jobs either helping entire species or at least small subsets, populations of them, to thrive. Or maybe even just so we can learn enough about them to help keep them going in the future. It's a wide-ranging field, and I never know what is coming down the pike.
Yeah. So now, I looked at your most recent stories, and there were 3 in a row about tigers. And I know there had been some seemingly good news about tigers, but why don't you kind of give us a little, you know, background on what that's all about?
Sure. Well, most people probably don't realize that tigers are endangered, if not critically endangered. For years now, conservationists have been using a single number to talk about tiger populations in the wild, and they've been saying that, there were about 3,200. Now, a few weeks ago, the World Wildlife Fund came out with a new number, about 3,800.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the question has come up, is that an increase? Is it good news? And it's yes and no.
Okay.
Part of the new number comes from the fact that we're just now slightly better at counting tigers. Because these are, you know, they're big, but they like to hide.
Yeah.
They're out there in the jungle. They're hard to count. They're hard to see. They're camouflaged. So we've gotten better at estimating their numbers. That's part of it. And yes, in some regions, tiger populations are increasing a little bit. But, you know, with the better ability to count, we realize that some areas have less than we thought they did. Bangladesh used to be estimated to have over 400 tigers. Now it's estimated at just 100. That doesn't mean they lost 300. It means they were counting them wrong in the first place.
Okay.
But the other problem is that tiger poaching is still rampant.
Yeah.
In so far this year in India, there have been more tigers poached than in all of last year. And there are so many being killed that even if the numbers are stable or increasing or whatever the case might be, it's unsustainable. Tiger populations cannot withstand the number that they're losing combined with the amount of habitat that they're losing through development and habitat destruction, et cetera.
So what is the consumer demand? What do people want from tigers, really? Come on.
Yeah. Well, it's all based out of Asia, and you've got multiple things going on. You've got the luxury market for their skins. But most importantly, you've got the desire to turn their body parts, their claws, their bones, their whiskers, et cetera, into so-called traditional Asian medicines.
Right.
And, you know, that might be in a lot of different ways, but one of the ways that I see a lot is called tiger bone wine. They take the bones of a tiger, they steep it in rice wine for weeks or months, and they sell it for thousands of dollars a bottle. And as I've reported, people in China are actually buying these things, not as much to use them, but to put them on a shelf as an investment in the hopes that tigers go extinct and that their bottle of gold is going to be worth more because there's nothing left out there.
That's insane. Seriously.
Yeah, you could say that.
So disturbing. And then you said something about whiskers. What on earth did they do with the whiskers of a tiger?
Well, they grind things up. They put them into medicines that can supposedly cure all kinds of things. I won't even bother mentioning what they are because they're bunk.
It's snake oil.
It's not proven by medical science at all.
Okay, so that's extremely disturbing on all levels. The idea that people will just they're kind of hedging their bets. They're betting against the tiger.
Yeah, they are.
Oh man! All right, that's all right. So, how do we shift that cultural? I mean, I don't know enough about it, but how does one kind of shift that cultural demand?
Well, part of it is education.
Yeah.
You just try to find out who those end consumers are and convince them this is not good. This is not sustainable.
Cut it out.
Part of it starts right here in the U.S.
Okay.
There are an unknown number of tigers living in people's backyards, in their houses, on private reserves that are just uncounted. And some people estimate there's as many as 5,000. And these are unregulated tigers for the most part. The U.S. just closed down a number of loopholes about this, which is going to help.
That was one of the articles I read, that there may be more tigers that don't have specific breeding papers, but more tigers here in captivity than there are actually in the wild?
That's absolutely true. And one of the weird things is not only do we not know where all these tigers are, we don't know what happens to them when they die. So are they contributing to this Asian medicinal market, it's quite likely.
You mean we have like tiger farms?
Well, we don't have tiger farms in the U.S. We have tiger breeders, that's for sure. But China does have several very large tiger farms, estimated as many as 10,000 tigers that are raised in horrid conditions with the just sheer expectation that eventually maybe there's going to be a wider legal market for these products. And there's a lot of people pushing for that. And the thing about Asian culture is that if you take something from the wild, it has more value than something that was raised in captivity on a farm or whatever.
Right.
So even though they've got all these captive tigers that can do that, that stimulates demand for the wild tigers, which puts yet even more pressure on them, and that's what's stimulating this increase in poaching.
Okay, so, big education, because I really, I'm semi-educated, and I really didn't know this was such a huge issue.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of studies that point to, I mean, let's say you see a commercial with a tiger or a nature special.
Yeah.
You know, you see this healthy animal, whether it's in the wild or semi-wild or you know, jumping in a commercial. So therefore, you think, well, I just saw a healthy tiger, therefore all tigers are healthy.
Yeah.
And you see this across species. You see it with chimpanzees and other things, where people have the perception, because they've just seen something vaguely happy, that everything's happy in the wild. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. So you have to break down through those barriers and get people to understand the trouble.
Okay. Well, you're doing your part, to be sure.
I am.
And I'm really glad that you are able to take some time and talk to us and help us get our audience out there educating themselves and everyone they know, because this is not okay.
Well, I'm happy to do it. And, you know, yes, it sounds bleak, but the more people know, the better we are, better chances we have of fixing it.
Well, thank you for staying on these topics and reporting them for us. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon, John.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Green Divas Heart Wildlife. Please visit thegreendivas.com, that's T-H-E, greendivas.com, to learn more about wildlife, nature, and a whole lot more.
Topic that is very often difficult to discuss. Some people get really agitated and concerned about it. It's a little taboo in some cultures or some circles, but for me, it's huge and not talked about enough, and that is population. You know, this world, I think we're somewhere around 7.4 billion people. And we're already struggling with climate change and resource diminishing resources like water, food, air, I suppose. But, you know, we're and I think according to some of the statistics I've read in articles, we're looking at over 11 billion estimated in 2100. That's less than 100 years. Our resources, you know, where they're going to be stretched mighty thin by then. And climate will be obviously proportionately, you know, stressed. So anyway, I'm really interested in talking to Alicia Graves, who is the co-founder and executive director of OASIS, which is the initiative. Wait a minute. OASIS Initiative, which is organizing to advance solutions in the Sahel. Among other things, obviously one of her focuses has been population growth and ways that we can work with that. Hi, Alicia.
Hi there, Meg.
So, yeah, wow. And, you know, you've got other titles in other organizations mostly related to population growth and And you had an article recently, and I think that's how we got connected, about green sex for climate's sake or something. It was a very clever title, but it was pretty powerful topic. So can you, you want to talk about the article and, you know, what you were trying to get through there?
Sure. Thanks. And I just also add that the OASIS Initiative is a project of University of California, Berkeley. I was invited to write a series of essays for a roundtable in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists on the issue of population and emissions, and specifically whether family planning should be considered a climate solution. And yes, I think that it should. There's a lot of evidence, of course, that population has a direct impact on the environment, including effects of climate change. And yeah. I think one thing I would point out, I'm glad you brought up the projected population for 2100, but it took all of human history until the 1800s for the first 1 billion people on Earth. Wow. So that's about 2.5 million years to put the first 1 billion.
Oh.
And the last billion, from 6 to 7 billion, took only 13 years. So there really is real acceleration in human population. It is beginning to slow, but you know, demographers a few years ago thought it would have been stabilized by 2100, and the most recent UN projections suggest that it will still be growing by the end of the century.
And so what has shifted in that projection? Is it life? Is it health and availability of accessibility of you know, medicine and health, or people just kind of, what's happening?
It really is a story of medical triumph, and through all of human history, the default has been a very large family, but a lot of those children didn't go on to live until their reproductive years,
right.
and beginning in the 1800s, that has changed. Now, in most parts of the developed world, population is starting to, the family size has gone to what we say replacement level, about 2 kids per family.
Right.
But most of the growth in this century, in fact, 99% of population growth this century will be in less developed countries, which is a really important demographic story.
Yeah,
and I want people not to be afraid to talk about it, because it actually is a major threat to development, because those countries are already struggling to provide basic services like health and education for their population, and it's going to be near impossible for them to develop in the face of that population growth and ensure food and basic education for populations that will be, you know, 3 times as large by middle of the century.
Well, I think Africa, you know, from what I've read, and I think your article brings it up, that Africa is really going to be a large contributor to the increase in population.
Yeah, that's right. The African, most sub-Saharan African countries have, you know, they say a demographic fertility stall. That is, the family sizes are not coming down. But there are about, for example, in the Sahel region, which my project is focused on,
okay.
This is the ecological zone that stretches across the widest part of Africa, and it's where the Sahara Desert turns to grasslands to the south. Among those countries, for example, there are 2 to 3 times as many women who say they want to space or prevent their next pregnancy who are not using contraception than there are women who are currently using contraception. So there's also tremendous opportunity to reach those women and couples.
So there is a potential solution if some of these women can get access, gain access to some safe birth control.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And access is a very important word. I think the reason in your introduction you talked about this being a sensitive topic. Something that we're trying to do with the Rebirth of Population Awareness Project at Venture Strategies is get population back on the world agenda,
yeah.
And let people know that there are decades of evidence from around the world that show that when women have good access and to the methods and information, and it's affordable, and she has the right to make choices,
yeah.
Then family size tends to fall.
Yeah, I think that's critical, and making sure that safe options are available and choices, you know, that a woman will make healthier choices in many cases, whatever, which may decrease some of the population. And yeah, there were some interesting comments on the essay you had written and the article that was associated with it. There were some really intense comments, and I can see where people get nuts because there's a fear of Big Brother controlling your womb by, you know, not allowing you. And I don't think that's what you're talking about at all.
No, absolutely not. And this is something because of some very tragic, coercive population programs in parts of the world. Again, people are afraid to touch the subject. And I think we need to get the message out that family planning is not about telling women what to do. It's about giving us what we want. And I take the case of the United States, where nearly half of all pregnancies are unintended. Mm-hmm. And women on average want about 2 children. So an average American woman spends about 5 years trying to get pregnant or you know, breastfeeding so she's not fertile.
Right.
And then she spends about 30 years trying to prevent unintended pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's I think that a lot of people aren't really, you know, they take advantage of the good access to family planning that they may have enjoyed, but not realizing what it's like for almost all women who want to determine their family size.
So from what I understand, what you're advocating and what your organizations are all about is about education, self-awareness, and helping people and women around the world have access to safe contraception so that they can make healthier choices. And your belief and your studies have shown that women will make those choices if given the access.
Yes, Meg, that's right. And you mentioned education. We're both trying to educate international decision makers. But there's also the question of education and how it relates to population. And there has been some research by the Population Council that shows that for every 5 years that a girl is delays marriage, there'll be about a 15% to 20% direct reduction in future population growth. And that's due for 2 reasons. One is she'll likely begin bearing children later, but she's more likely to have been educated, and she's mm-hmm. more likely to be able to negotiate with her partner and overcome all of these barriers to getting family planning. So education, which is adolescent girls' education, is very low in most of sub-Saharan Africa, is critical, and we are arguing for commensurate investments in adolescent girls' education as well as family planning.
Well, I am just all in favor of the work you're doing in so many ways, and we could talk for a lot longer, but we have to close up this segment. So tell people quickly how they can find out more.
I would point you to our website, which is oasisinitiative.berkeley.edu. And we are looking for partnerships and for new friends of the Sahel. So thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, well, I'll look forward to catching up with you again. Thank you so much, Alicia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Green Divas Radio Show. Be sure to look for this and other Green Diva Network podcasts on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, iTunes, Swell Radio, and Spreaker. Get social with the Green Divas on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Subscribe to the Green Divas YouTube channel to watch them in action. And for all the latest good green news, visit thegreendivas.com. That's THE greendivas.com.